Welcome to episode 24 of the Rex Chapman Show with
super cool,
super sexy, super hot, super dumb, but super sexy.
What was the part you said before that?
Sexy, super cool,
after.
Super smart,
yeah,
super dumb, super hot.
Yeah, well,
Josh Hopkins, Josh Hopkins. Super cool, super
okay, hot. Cool, awesome.
Josh Hopkins, a little bit dumb. And so welcome to episode 24, the Jamal Mashburn episode 24.
Yes.
What's another 24? We don't have Jamal Mashburn today. We've had Jamal Mashburn.
This Mr. is just Kobe Bryant.
Kobe Bryant. That's a great 24. Well
That's
done.
Probably the all-time 24. Although I do say I loved it when Kobe was 8.
Yeah.
That was, to me, that was just a cool number. It was would have just been his number, 8.
Yeah. It still is.
Didn't he get retired as both? So anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
24. All right. Ken Griffey Jr.
Good one.
Thank you. A good one? It's just a good one? A
great one. Well, we've had two 24s in some regard on the show in MASH and Jimmy Jackson.
Oh, that's right. That is right.
Can't forget the 24s we've had.
You know who we have today, Josh? And I'm just going to tease it for a second before we get into some other stuff. We've got Martina Navratilova today.
That kidding aside here, that blows me away. That's iconic.
Does me too.
That's our childhood. That's, tennis
I'm nervous.
On Sundays, right? I mean, that was, all, it was.
I'm nervous. Was,
I am really nervous.
She's an icon.
Yep.
She's an icon. She's on my Mount Rushmore. I mean, growing up in the 80s, I just can't even. Yeah. I'm excited and nervous.
When tennis was on then, you had to watch it. You wanted to watch it, but there were 800 channels and that came on and it was sport. Not everything had sports was on. It was, maybe local news and stuff. And that was on and it was amazing.
Her whole life is amazing, right?
Yes,
she was, she was a super, superstar. Serena before Serena. Like, she was just different.
Heyday of that sport, too, with the rivalries.
Oh.
That seemed like the golden age of tennis.
Yeah, amazing. Anyway, well, I'm excited and nervous. But just really honored that she's coming on our silly show.
Too.
Hey, Josh. I haven't read anything this week at all. I meant to this week, just because I had some time.
Right.
But I didn't read anything. Did you read anything this week?
I actually had quite a bit of time, but I neglected to watch anything. I watched a lot of TV and stuff. So that's been book club. Okay, what else is going on, buddy? Anything? How's Kentucky? How's Lexington?
Kentucky's good. A little overcast yesterday. Hot as Hades today. I think that's what my mom used to say. It is hot as Hades out there.
Not as hot as here. Not as hot in Austin. It's walking on the sun here. It's walking on the sun.
Ugh.
So that's been the weather report. Okay. What else we got?
We got that. I'm excited to talk to Martine. We should just get right into it.
Yeah,
she's,
I agree.
She's, there's a lot of stuff I want to ask her about. Hopefully she'll be up for being an open book like I know she has been most of her life. I want to talk to her about some mental health stuff. I'm excited.
Let's do it.
Thank you for doing this, Martine.
You're episode 24, only now you're asking me to be on this? It's all right. I can handle it.
We're so lucky that you said yes. I mean, such an icon. We talked to a lot of people and big basketball players for basketball guys. I'm really kind of nervous. I'm just so excited that you're here and freaked out that I'm talking to you. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Don't freak out too much.
Well, and I'm going to echo the same. And we were just talking before you came on. You were just such a huge influence. We both grew up in Kentucky. And, when you were just on fire in the late 70s and 80s, we were, you know, teenagers watching your every move. And you, I told you the other day when I DM'd you, you know, you're on my Mount Rushmore. So, and my mom and dad played tennis religiously growing up, and I would go to the, their tennis matches. And I started learning how to play tennis. And I was one of the first guys. I would play with my group of guys, but they would all, you know, pretend to be Jimmy Dan and Agassi and everybody else. I could pretend to be Martina, and I loved playing. I loved watching you play. And so thank you for being here. One of the things that I was wondering in reading up more on you is about your relationship with Nancy Lieberman. She's a, you know, basketball icon. And when I was coming up in the 80s, you know, she actually tried out for the Pacers, the right. Indiana Pacers. And how did you two come across one another?
Well, her league folded, right? And she was just wanted to play. I mean, to think that the greatest basketball player in the world, but she's done after college. There's no place for her to go unless she went to Europe and played some team basketball there, the leagues. But she came to a tournament with a mutual friend, a tennis player. She came to a tournament in Amelia Island back in 1981. And of course, we recognized each other, started talking, and then started doing more than that. And, you know, we're in a relationship for 3 years. But it was Nancy that pushed me into training and really getting in much better shape. I had no idea what basketball training was like, but she introduced me to it pretty quickly. I started doing suicide drills and learned how to
That's
do it.
That's amazing.
I did not play basketball at all. So, you know, I was a totally blank slate and eager student. I loved it. So we played a lot of 2-on-2 full court. 3-on-3 full court, 1-on-1
wow.
full court. We didn't play half court because it was about training, right? So we a little man, big man. I played a lot of that as well, 2-on-1.
You learned how to play because you didn't grow up dribbling a basketball or pass. You learned the rules in a short amount of time like that and were able to play with.
I mean, I watched basketball. I just didn't play. There was, you know, there was no place to play, but, yeah, we did a lot of sliding drills. Footwork is very similar, especially now, even more so.
Yes.
Because in the old days, it was cross step in tennis. Right now, it's sidestep, open stance. So the defensive drill, you know, we did 2 minute in a squad going sideways. You point, you slide, always open body. And so it was much more relevant to tennis than I knew then. But it just really got me strong and fit. And it was fun. I hate running long distance. I did that to get a base. But I love fast training, whether it was running sprints on the track or playing basketball, or later I played hockey, tennis. I love fast sports. So, you know, I'll play basketball till I literally can't move anymore. But tell me to go for a half an hour run and I'm like, oh, my goodness, you know, shoot me. I hate that slow stuff. My sister loves it. Go figure. But me, no. So I loved that training. And Nancy was the one that really turned the light on for me and made me realize how much more I could be doing. And that's when it all started. I started training in the summer of 81. And then Rene Richards started being my coach after the US Open in 81. And that's when I started winning everything because I had the right team around me. Before that, I was doing it on my own. For 6 years, I didn't have a coach. You know, I was alone.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. How frustrating though, you know, because, you know, we heard all the, you know, rumors and people thinking that you were doing things that, you know, that weren't natural, and you were just working your ass off.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, and it wasn't even really things that the media could write at that point. It was just whispers from people and rumors. And how frustrating and hard was that? And in this time, you know, maybe I didn't want to ask this quite yet, but mental health with what's going on right now, Naomi Osaka, Simone Biles, being a young person and having to be in the public eye like that, going through everything that you had gone through personally, how difficult was that?
So this could be a really long answer. So I'll try.
That's okay.
Short, but right now, everybody's under a much bigger microscope, right? And the social media, you can't sneeze without somebody getting it on their camera and posting it. So it's really, really, the stress is, I don't know if it's magnified, but it's just different. And it's all, I think it's different. It's worse because it's always present. Even when you try to get off social media, it takes effort to get off it, right? To not read it.
Yes.
It sucks the energy out of you, even if you're strong. And then if you have any kind of foibles, you know, it really attacks you in so many ways. So it's more difficult in that way. But for me, leaving my family when I was, you know, 18, and it was a one-way ticket, right? Leaving Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic, it was a one-way ticket. I didn't know if I would ever see my family again. So it was a big commitment. So after that, everything was easy. What could be tougher than that? So whether it was coming out or playing matches or, you know, traveling on my own and learning how to drive on the left side of the road in UK, you know, with a stick shift on the left side, alone, arriving at the tournament in Eastbourne at midnight, you know, you did what you had to do, because I've already done the hardest thing that I ever had to do. It was, but what was hard when I started winning and doing everything, as you said, the whispers, you know, of course, she must be doing steroids. It was dehumanizing. Yes. Either I'm doing drugs, or I'm actually a man, or I have an unnatural advantage because I'm a lesbian, as if that would do something to my ability. And then I remember there was a cartoon when I really wasn't losing hardly at all. There was one stretch where I lost 6 matches in 3 years.
What a slump.
So there was a cartoon saying, they were accusing me of being a robot because I was winning, you know, so automatically. And then the cartoon was, I'm not me saying I'm not a robot, you know, dehumanizing. Dehumanizing. And that's what really pisses me off, because I don't think they would do it to guys. I don't think they would do it to straight women. I don't think they would do it to people from France or England. You know, it was a communist country, a Slavic country, all of that combined. It's like, and then I had muscles. I always had muscles.
Yeah.
You know, I was benching the other day. I started doing some training because I want to get in better shape for skiing, so I can ski all day and ski hard. So I started training, and I started bench pressing again. And, you know, I benched 85 pounds 8 times, you know, 3 sets. I'm 64 years old. I shouldn't be able to do that. You know, I still have the guts. And in third grade, our teacher in third grade was explaining how the muscles work and how the bicep works. And she had me go to the class, to front of the class, and flex my biceps, because I had bigger biceps than the boys in third grade. So, yeah, I don't think I was doing steroids. It's, you know, it's DNA.
And where does that come from? Is that your mom and dad?
Both my parents were amazing bodies and great athletes. So I got the DNA, and then I worked at it. You know, I worked my ass off. I was benching 140 pounds, you know, when I was playing and squatting over 300 pounds, you know, sets of 8 or 10. So, and I never took anything, never touched anything. I remember being in a gym. I was pretty cut. And this 15-year-old boy says, what do you think about blah, blah, blah? And he said some word, I don't know what it was. And I'm like, what? He says, what do you think about blah? I'm like, is that a steroid? He says, yes. I'm like, don't even think about taking any of that stuff. And I never took it. He didn't know who I was. He just thought I was a bodybuilder. And so I'm like, I was mortified that he wanted to do that. And that, of course, he assumed that I was doing, because I'm a woman, and I was, you know, I had muscles bigger than most women. I like my body.
It's
too much.
So amazing. It's so amazing. And when I think back, you know, growing up in Kentucky, there was definitely you and Chris Everett had and she was obviously amazing. And you had this amazing rivalry, but there was definitely a Chris Everett bias when I think back. And you both were so different. You were more of a physical player and powerful. What made her so difficult for you?
Well, she was first of all much better athlete than she even gave herself credit for. She would have excelled in other sports, but between the ears, she was so strong. I learned watching her how she carried herself on the court and off the court, how she was just so controlled and so focused. you would never know whether she was winning or losing by looking at her. She had the same expression. Yeah. And with me, you always knew how I was feeling. I always tried every point, but I would be really get down on myself. And she was so controlled, and she knew what the other player was thinking and feeling. I was clueless. Again, I didn't have a coach for 6 years, but even after I had a coach, I didn't really think about the emotional or mental part of it all. Because again, coming from a communist country, you just get on with it. You know, you deal with it. You don't have the option of, you know, saying, oh, well, this is really hard emotionally. It's like, you know, kids in, you know, I spent a lot of time in Kenya. Kids in Kenya don't have not PTSD. They don't have ADD or an ADD.
Yeah.
They don't have time for that. Right? They're busy carrying water 3 miles.
Yes.
And walking to school 5 miles every day. They don't have time to have those kinds of emotions. And again, growing up where I grew up, I was never hungry or cold, but it was not easy. We didn't have, you know, we didn't have hot running water until I was like 12 years old. So we had running water, but it was cold. So you just get on with it. And so I never really paid enough attention to the mental aspect of the game until much later in my career.
No, you mentioned growing up in Czechoslovakia, and I have an interest in that. I was fortunate enough a couple of years ago to work in Prague for a year, and I realized then I didn't know much about the history, as many Americans aren't educated about stuff like that. We're very self-centric in that way, as you know. But I just find it so interesting that you were there for the Prague Spring in 1968, 12 or 13, you said, and lived through that. And for a lot of people that don't know, you know, Czechoslovakia was occupied for years, especially after World War II. The Soviets came in, really beat down a lot of the country, its soul in a lot of ways. In 1968, Czechoslovakia started to get a little mojo back. It was led by intellects and artists and stuff. They started to feel the culture again, and it was a little freer and started to feel good about it, and thought the Soviets would be okay. We've been here for a long time. And the Soviets weren't like that. They came in with tanks to let them know who was in charge, and really crushed the spirit of the country that point. And you were there for that time. And what do you remember about that? And then what do you say, just your perspective now on people that today, especially in politics, throw around the words like socialism and communism, and that's what really to scare people with it. What do you say about real communism and socialism compared to what you see now?
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, Bernie and Sanders may be calling himself socialist, but I think he's socialist on the social issues, in that he wants people to have equal access and opportunity. But he's certainly not a communist or a socialist in the way that the communism was, which is telling you what to do, how to do it, and what you are allowed to say or do, etc., or else there are repercussions. So in 68, it started 67, the Prague Spring, but it really came to fruition in the spring of 68, and that's when the Soviet Union realized that we need to quell this. And we had a joke back in Czechoslovakia back then that we have the biggest car in the world, in that we have the car in Czechoslovakia, but the steering wheel is in Moscow. Yeah, they decided what was going on, right? What would and then there's another joke I have to say now, propaganda, which is kind of relevant to what's going on today. There was a race between Nixon and Brezhnev, you know, the only two guys running. And Nixon wins and Brezhnev finishes second. And the Soviet newspaper says, well, our esteemed president finished in a very good second place, while the American president finished one before last. There you are.
Yeah. One before last.
True, but.
Yeah. Right?
Anyway, so in 68, I was actually playing a tournament in Pilsen, a junior tournament in Pilsen. My dad just took me there on our motorcycle on like a Thursday. The tournament starts Friday. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Pilsen was about 60 miles, you know, like a 2-hour ride on the motorcycle. And Friday morning, my friends, I stayed with my best friends who we were playing doubles together. The father calls at 8 in the morning. He says, don't go outside. There is Russian tanks on the streets. that's when the Russians came in, 21st of on overnight, 20th of August to 21st of August. Actually, the anniversary is in a couple of days. So, of course, we went onto the street to check it out and, you know, started throwing rocks at the tanks. But then we thought maybe we shouldn't do that because those guys had guns and we didn't. We had rocks. 600,000 soldiers the Russians sent, Soviets, I should say, for supposedly 25,000 dissidents in the whole country. So, yeah, it was bullshit. They just quelled any unrest or any ideas that we had of being free and a democratic country. My cousin actually at the time was in the Czech army because you had to do 2 years in the army and they were told to stand down. They were not allowed to fight. That order came from the top. And that was that. So that was the end of the Prague Spring. And we knew our life would never be the same or would get worse. Whatever freedoms we might have had were now gone. So then when I defected in 75, because the Federation was basically telling me when I could or could not leave, to get out of the country, to go anywhere, you had to get visa. And to go to a capitalist country, to go out west, you had to get a permission from the government first before you could go to the embassy to get the visa. So if you don't get the permission from the Czech government to travel to Italy or France or wherever in Western Europe, you don't go anywhere. You have your passport, but you don't have the visa, you don't go. So you're at the mercy of the government, whether you can leave the country or not. And so when they said, oh, we're not gonna let you play the US Open because you were too friendly with the Americans and blah, blah, blah. That's when I realized if they ever let me out again, I'm gonna have to not go back because I would not be able to control my destiny. So that happened because of 68. You know, the freedoms were squashed that much more. Before that, more people could travel out west, but after 68, it was really a disaster. So a lot of people immigrated as soon as they could or escaped over the border with Austria or West Germany. And anyway, so life was never the same.
Well, not to fanboy out too much, but I had this a long time before I knew you were going to be on here. And there was a quote in there that I thought was great. You said, this is sort of paraphrasing, but you said, when you're 12 or 13 and your country's verve and spirit gets knocked down like that, what are you to do when you have aspirations and goals and a skill? There's only one thing to do, and it's get out. And you mentioned in the book, I thought that was great. You mentioned in the book that you were really enamored with Western culture, American culture growing up, you know, every little bit, a morsel of a record, whatever you took in. But when you actually got to America for the first time, got off the plane, what were you surprised with? Because, you know, growing up with so much propaganda against American culture and whatnot, what surprised you or what delighted you?
Well, I didn't believe the propaganda. So we knew life was much better out west. I've actually been to West Germany in 69 and 70. So I knew what life was like in the West. But then when I first came to America, it's actually funny because my first tournament in America was in Fort Lauderdale, which is where I'm right now. The airport's about 10 miles away. And the biggest shock, I've already seen the big cars because when I was in Germany, there were American bases there. So there were American cars, but the size of the cars, you know, the Buicks and Cadillacs and Fords, what have you, it was just astonishing. Next to the Czech cars, I don't know if you saw the German cars, they're like little, you know, little Fiat 500, Cinquecento size, right? So it was just the size of the cars here. Even though I've seen it in Germany, it was amazing. There were coconuts on the trees that you could actually pick, and which I did. I took a coconut and took about 3 hours to get into it, just, you know, a little hammer and screwdriver. But I got into that coconut, and then when you got a ham sandwich at the grocery store, at the coffee shop, it was like, you know, two pieces of bread and this much ham, right? Proper Jewish sandwich. In Czech Republic, it was a thick piece of bread and one slice of ham. So, you know, it was like luxury beyond belief here. Luxury. And I just wanted to share that ham with my family. I remember when I was eating that sandwich, I'm like, this is just amazing. And I was just, I was 16 years old. And I was just sad that my family couldn't be with me. I was in America for 2 months and it was like, wow, everything is just, you know. And there's oranges on the trees. I mean, I'm in Fort Lauderdale, right? I'm in Florida. It was Martina, like being in a,
How many people knew you were you were defecting, that you were going to leave. And when very the time...
Very few. My only
not your parents?
My parent. Well, my dad knew that I was probably going to do it. And he said, if you do it, don't come back, no matter what we tell you. My mom didn't know. So I can't talk about it because I'll start crying.
I'm sorry.
It was really hard. But the people that did know was my agent who arranged my actual defection. When I had to go to the Immigration and Naturalization Service in Manhattan. So he knew we were going to do it after I'm out of the US Open. I lost to Chris in the semifinals. And that night or the next day, I can't remember. I think I lost on a Thursday and Friday. We left. Sorry, my dog is yapping.
It's okay.
I'll let her out.
it's a theme of this podcast. So don't worry. We got dogs on every episode. Well,
I'm in the office because we also have birds. And if you hear some weird screams, it's the birds. It's not people. So Chris Evertnew, Billie Jean King, my agent, his daughter, who was also on the tour, Sherry Barman, my agent, was Fred Barman, who just passed away like last year.
Was 100 and sorry.
He was 100 years old. Yeah. It was a good effort, right?
Yeah.
that was so it was like four or five people knew that was it.
So you didn't have like our view of it, and you things you hear like you didn't have handlers there that were watching it, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we think.
Oh, I had a really great handler. Me.
Yeah. Well, good.
Yeah, no, we did not have teams. We did not have people around us. Even people that had coaches, they only had coaches at home. Nobody traveled with their player. I think Bjorn Borg was and Jimmy Connors with his mother were the only people that really traveled with their coaches and not to all tournaments. So
no, I don't even mean coaches. I mean like handlers. We think there's like
Soviet
from
the Union government
coming with you, watching you. That didn't happen.
Oh, those handlers. Yeah. I had, Vera Sukova, who was Helena Sukova's mother, who I played against in the finals of the US Open. She was the coach and handler of our team. And so there was like two other players, I think, with us at that, women players. And like three male players, Jan Kodesh played at that time, and Renata Tomanova, my another good friend. So when I went to the office of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, obviously I didn't tell her, but we had freedom. We didn't have to be with the coaches all the time or the handlers, so we could go to the movies on our own. But of course, I didn't tell her. And so when I went to the office, we went after hours. They said come after 6 o'clock, so nobody knows that you're here. So we can keep it quiet. Don't tell anybody. Okay. And filled out all the paperwork. I was there till about 10:30 at night. Made sure that they knew, you know, they kept asking, are you in the Communist Party? Is your father a communist? So I had to assure them that I was not a communist. I was not a spy. I just wanted to play tennis. And I finally left there at 10:30. The guy said,
you'd have been a great spy. You'd have been a great spy.
Alice Morrow was a spy, but that's another story. So there were only like two or three people that I met when I was there that, you know, because it was empty offices Friday night. And in the morning, so I go back to my hotel, the Roosevelt Hotel, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, my phone rings and it's Vera Sukova, the handler coach, says, why did you do it? I'm like, did what? I was sound asleep. She says, why did you do it? I'm like, oh my God, she knows. I'm like, how do you know? She says, it's in the Washington Post. Wow. It was in the newspaper that morning, like literally 6 hours later, it's in the newspaper. Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, so then all hell broke loose and I did a press conference why I defected. And and then I had people helping me to make sure that I would stay safe, that the Czechs wouldn't try to take me back. I wasn't worried about that. I didn't think they would, but possibility was there. If I was from Russia, I would have worried about that. But Czechs were not quite that severe. And in fact, there was a guy that followed me around for a couple more weeks because my visa was still until like October. So technically I could have gone back. And Vera Sukova said, please come back. You know, nothing will happen to you if you come back before your visa expires. And I'm like, no, it's not going to happen. So that was that.
Were you worried about repercussions to your family?
Yes. Like, yes, I was. And it did happen, but it wasn't horrible, but it was still difficult. My parents both lost their jobs, but they got like smaller jobs, but they still had a job. And then after like a couple of years, my dad got back to his old job. They were both, they had already been had repercussions against them back in the 40s, because initially they belonged to the Communist Party in 1945. But once they realized what the communists were actually doing, they left. And then my mom got thrown out of school because of her political views, because she was not on board with the communists. Same with my dad. He was not allowed to go to the school that he wanted to go to because of his politics. So they've already had that stuff. You know, they've already gone through that in their 20s. And then my sister was not allowed to go to the school that she wanted to go to, high school or college, rather. She wanted to go to an art school. But after I defected, she was a persona non grata. So she had a hard time just getting into college, period. Ended up studying dentistry. With the help of a friend getting into school. And my parents lost their big job, but they still got paid the same. And there was just a slightly smaller, you know, they were not going to be sent to Siberia. That I knew. Had I thought that would have been, again, if I had come from Soviet Union, I don't think I would have defected because it would have been too risky for the rest of my family.
Wow. So you didn't just come from great physical genes, came great mental genes, people that were stood up for what they believed in despite the consequences. That's amazing.
Martina, I can't believe it. It's 40 years ago that you were outed.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as you were just talking about, you know, being a teenager and going through what all you've gone through, you get here to America and, you know, I can't imagine, I'm sure you just wanted to be yourself. But you're also going through an immigration process. And right. I'm sure a lot of that was I'm sure some of it was taken into consideration. How difficult was that part of it for you? And dealing with, you know, again, the whispers and the pundits.
Sure. So I had my first experience with a woman. I was 18 and a half, I guess, almost 19, 18 and a half. And that's when I'm like, oh, that's what those crushes were. You know, I didn't really put two and two together, but I'm like, okay, my life is going to be more complicated, but it is what it is. And that's basically all the thought I gave it to. And then there were reporters that were asking me about, are there lesbians on the tour? They would never ask a guy, are they gay guys on the tour? They never ask a guy, are you gay? No, but they were free enough to ask a woman. Anyhow, again, more sexism, but you know, what else is new? So I couldn't talk about it because, number one, my parents didn't know. So I wasn't going to come out and not tell my family first. And my parents didn't ask. So I said, don't ask, don't tell. If they don't ask, I'm not going to tell them. If they ask, I'll tell them. So I did in 1980 when they came to live here for a while. And I couldn't talk about it publicly because it could be a disqualifier to become a citizen. Mm. Right. So it was against the law.
Wow.
So I had to be quiet about it until I got my citizenship. And then once I get my citizenship, then I can talk about it. So one of those reporters would ask me, I'm like, I can't talk about it, Steve, because I need to get my citizenship first. And so I get my citizenship. And like 2 weeks later, not even, he tracks me down in Monte Carlo. I was playing an exhibition there. And he says, how about it? Well, meantime, Billie Jean King was outed by her ex-girlfriend. This is maybe 4 months earlier. And I was told by our WTA people, the Women's Tennis Tour, that because I told them as soon as I got my citizenship, I was going to come out. And they said, okay. And then after the Billie Jean scandal, where she, you know, she lost all her endorsements. She had been in a relationship with this woman, but not anymore. But she was still married, but not whatever. And then she had to prove that she was straight, but she still lost all her endorsements. So she was on the cover of People magazine saying, oh no, I'm still with my husband, because she was not ready to come out. And I was told by the WTA to not say anything, not come out, don't come out now, because our sponsor said, if there is one more scandal, we're going to pull the sponsorship off the tour. Right.
So I'm scandal, a scandal.
It was a huge scandal back then. Yeah. Well, this is 40 years ago. So this is a big no-no. So corporate America certainly wasn't supportive. I mean, even in the 90s, Subaru was like the first big company that came out and publicly supported the gay and lesbian community. Everybody else was in the closet, so to speak, about their support. They were doing surreptitiously, not openly. Subaru was the first one that really did it openly, as far as I know. But this is in the 90s. So this is 81. So the Steve Goldstein calls me from the Daily News, says, are you ready to talk about it? I'm like, Steve, I can't talk about it because of the sponsorship. We would lose sponsors. blah, blah, blah. He says, okay. I said, you're not going to talk about it, are you? He says, not if you don't want me to. Well, of course I don't want you to. 2 days later, Daily News comes out. Martina is a bisexual, but she can't talk about it because they would lose sponsors. It's like, which part of don't talk about it did you not understand? Yeah. Long story short, I was outed this way, even though I was so ready to come out for years, but held it until I got my citizenship. And then this whole thing happened. Then Billie Jean came out finally, like 14 years later. She was still trying to, you know, play it cool and not be ostracized as a lesbian. So anyway, I didn't care. And, you know, I didn't care because I knew I could still play tennis. Had I been on a team sport, it would have been a different story. Then you have, you know, it's like being in the army. You get thrown out. You're on a team. The coach may not put you in, but I was not on a team. I was in an individual sport that is not judgmental. It balls either in or out. It doesn't matter what you wear, how you look. If you look pretty while you're hitting that forehand, as long as that ball goes in. So I was safe in that way. You know, my parents were not going to throw me out. I'd already left my home.
You'd already done the hardest thing.
Yeah, exactly. I was not going to lose my job because I could still play tennis, and the endorsements, whatever. If they come, it's a plus. If they don't, if I lose endorsements because of that, I can still play. So, you know, I was kind of pressure-free that way. But that's how it all happened. That's how it all came down. And to this day, Steve, the reporter says, oh, you said it's okay to say that. No, I didn't, because I was worried about the tour. I didn't care about me because, you know, I was okay. I was going to be okay no matter what. And I was okay.
That's amazing, the strength it takes. It just opens it. I don't mean to jump to this, but here you are, what you've gone through, describing that, and how far ahead of the curve you were, how you wanted to come out then, how, you know, the bravery it took. And here you are, human rights, gay rights, political rights, your entire life. And then you've been called transphobic and said some people, you know, said you maybe even tried to inspire a violence against trans people because you said that there needs to be more dialogue about trans people in the sports community, in women's sports and sports as a whole. And just because you say there's more debate to be had in this subject, you are attacked mercilessly. How are we supposed to learn and grow without debate, especially if someone like you, who's been through what you've been, can't just mention that there should be more debate and you step into a hornet's nest. What are we supposed to do now?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, what's the key to any good relationship? Communication. You need to have that communication, which means debate, which means speaking to each other, not at each other, and not just a one-way conversation. So yeah, it's been crazy that, you know, I've been called all kinds of names, but you know, I have my own compass. I kind of try to do the right thing always. And, you know, I've been kind of ahead of the curve on many, many ways on social issues, even training wise, I was kind of ahead of the curve. I was kind of a pioneer in more ways than I knew about way back. Sure. I was doing cross training when I was a little kid, you know, because I was swimming in the river and skating on it in the winter and played soccer and rode my bicycle and climbed up trees. And, you know, I was doing all this stuff long before I knew this is good for me. I just like doing it. So I was kind of ahead of the curve in many ways. And certainly, you know, Renee Richards was my coach. She's transsexual, transgender now they call. It's different, but she had the sexual reassignment surgery back in the 70s, sued to play on the women's tour. I was her biggest proponent and supporter, played doubles together, and then she became a coach, and we to this day we're friends. And now she says trans women should not be allowed to play elite sports. We have an advantage. I shouldn't have been allowed to play. There's an advantage. There's no, and that you can't mitigate. So they're calling her irrelevant now. They can't call her transphobic because she's a transgender, but they're calling her irrelevant because she's old. She doesn't know what she's talking about. It's like, really? She's lived it. She's lived this life for 50 years, but she doesn't know what she's talking about. Okay, got it. Anyhow.
That's amazing. I didn't know that was her stance now, because I know then she took it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, she did. But again, she realizes now. She was in her 40s when she was able to play. as a man, she was an average player, probably not even top 100 in the world.
How did you play against her?
I played against her. I was number one or number two in the world. I barely beat her. I did not lose to her, but I barely, like 7-6, 6-3. That was where the score.
Yeah.
It was close matches. And only because she was slow. You know, she's tall and she's slow and she's in her 40s. She didn't train for like 10 years. She didn't play tennis. She didn't train. She didn't do anything. If she had trained and she was 30 or 10 years younger, she would have beat us. She would have beat us because she was, you know, tall, strong, and still male biology leftovers from when she went through puberty way back. And so those advantages you can't really mitigate. So it's difficult. We're trying to find a way for trans women to be able to compete against women athletes at the elite level, but it's difficult. It's really tricky. So we'll see how we come out on that front. But for anybody to be calling me phobic anything, you know, the only phobia I have is against people that don't get vaccinated. Seriously.
Well, we connected obviously through social media and Twitter, and I love what you do. And I also, you know, read that you'd said once, you know, if they would have had Twitter when I was playing, I would have been giving them hell.
Right.
In thinking back at 20 years old, though, if we'd have had Twitter, could you have been giving them hell yet? Right.
Well, once I got my citizenship, then.
There you go. Right. There are always those things. And I think about, you know, Naomi Osaka right now and going through a difficult time. And I remember being interviewed as a young person growing up in Kentucky just because I could play basketball at 15, 16 years old. And, you know, just being swarmed by media asking me things. And I just really want to say, you know, hey, I'm sad today. I don't know why you're asking me this, but that wasn't the manly thing to do. So right. I stood there and pretended. Given that everything is so present, like you said today, can you imagine, you know, being a 16, 18 year old phenom like you are, all of these kids have social media now. Yeah. They have teams of people that kind of, they're brands. You were a brand before we said that, you know. Can you imagine what it would be like today?
I'd rather not. I mean, you know, you see the kids, they always have their face in their phone or their iPad. I do that now, you know, I'm on my iPad and at the same time while the TV's on without the sound on, right? I mean, it's like, but I can multitask pretty well, but it's still too much. And really the now this generation of players and athletes is the first one that never knew life without those phones, without social media, without the internet. And it's a different mindset, no doubt. And again, the pressures are, the magnifying glass, particularly for women, they really can't misstep. If they do, they get punished, as you know, Rex, much more than men.
Yes.
Whether it's girls in school, colored girls more so than white girls, but girls more than boys, women more than men, they get higher sentences for the same crimes. They get fired for the same thing that the guys just get a slap on the wrist, and women really can't do those missteps. So you feel that much more stressed. But we've heard the word depression or mental health from male athletes as well, not just the women. But I think women are under a bigger microscope for, you know, the sexual, I mean, we're sex objects more so than men, right?
Right.
So you judge much more how you look, how you dress, how's your hair, you know. I mean, I see women now, players, and they have lipstick on when they're playing a match. Like, really? I mean, some did mascara back in the day, but really? I'm always marveling that they don't smear it. But, you know, they're putting on makeup when they're playing tennis matches. I'm like, you know,
makeup technology's come a long way for women. It's really.
So women are, I think women and girls are under much more stress than boys. And the image that is out there is not achievable. You have
right.
Most beautiful women, models, right? Have the best makeup, have the best hair, lighting, photographers, and then they still fix the photos.
Photoshop. Still fix it.
Photoshop those photos. It's impossible. And so, you know, that's why you see all these mental issues and kids committing suicide because they can't get to that, or anorexia. But boys now have bulimia. I mean, it's just, enough already. Just let them be kids and let them be women, let them be girls, and don't judge every stupid word that comes out of their mouth. Because, you know, I said some really stupid stuff. I made some horrible jokes, but I didn't know any better. You know, I wore fur coats. I had a fur coat. Once I realized what happened to those animals, then I gave them all away. But I was stupid enough to wear them. I was stupid enough to make horrible jokes. Now I would be mortified what came out of my mouth. But, you know, I learned.
Same here.
It's called evolution, right? You evolve. You try to do better. And we do. We do better. We try. We know. We know what we don't know.
Yeah.
And we're willing to admit it. Anyway.
Oh my goodness, Martina. I can't thank you enough for doing this. Real quick, what's your favorite movie?
By the way, I have a good jump shot as a basketball player. I gotta give you, so Nancy taught me how to, you know, scoop the person as you're going for a layup.
Yeah. That's right.
The ball with the other hand as you're doing the layup. Protect, so they slap your hand, but you still make the layup. and put the elbow in when you're she taught me all the dirty tricks as well. But I'm a pretty basketball player because I shoot lefty, but I do better layup righties, like a toss on the serve, and I dribble better with my right.
That's right.
And I go better to my right than my left, but I can do left-handed layups as well, but I'm better with my right hand. So I'm kind of a mix mishmash.
We were just talking about that. We were talking about your backhand, and we couldn't remember. You did two-handed backhand, but
that way, but then I only did one hander. Then my coach, when I had a coach at 9, he taught me one-handed backhand. So I started out as a two-hander, but I could do a two-hander, but I didn't use it when I played. No,
you played, but you were one of the few women that used the one-hander at the time, weren't you?
No. Back then it was mostly one-handers. Chris was the first two-hander.
I got it backwards.
Two-handers and very few one-handers. On the men's side, it's making more of a comeback, but it's easier to hit it with two hands, but then you're limited in some ways. So there's pluses and minuses. But anyway, I started as a two-hander because that's the only way I could hold my grandmother's racket. I was 5 years old and I could hold it with one hand.
Right.
Yeah. I could have two hands. It was an old wooden racket, wooden handle.
But you have a favorite basketball player?
So I would have been, I'm decent. I play aggressive. I played with Nancy, and you know, she told me I couldn't play college ball, but
she told you couldn't or you could?
I could.
Well, of course you could. I can only imagine you would.
But I couldn't dunk. I came about this close to touching the rim, which is not bad for a white
kid.
But, you know.
So did I.
And he's 6'4".
Well, you're a little bit taller than I am.
He's 6'4".
Yeah. Okay. I can't jump. They can.
Yeah, I could touch the red part on a red, white, and blue net. I could touch the red part. Do you have a favorite movie?
My favorite movie, there's few, but anything with Katharine Hepburn in it. She was my favorite. So I love one old Golden Pond and not Casablanca, African Queen, Bringing a Baby, all her movies I love.
Were those movies you were able to see, like, kind of? No, never.
No, we couldn't see. I only saw that once I left the country. So that was all.
Wow.
The other day, somebody was saying Citizen Kane, and I know I need to see it. But I've never seen Citizen Kane, so I need to watch that.
Yeah, you should. You should.
Wells. Yeah. Front row center to see any band, speaker, whatever, dead or alive, front row center, who would you choose?
I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Okay.
I would have just liked to pick her brain. In fact, just the other day, I wore the T-shirt. You can't handle the Ruth.
I've got one in my closet. Yes.
I think
amazing
would be people that probably are not alive anymore, you know, like Alexander the Great and Greta Garbo, Maria Callas, you know, the people that were kind of ahead of their time.
Yeah.
Michelangelo and of course Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, I kind of aim high.
Josh asked you, do you have a favorite basketball player?
My favorite basketball player? Michael Jordan, of course. LeBron, he just kind of takes over. But Giannis Antetokounmpo. I actually know how to spell his name.
She is real, Josh. I told you she was real. You were saying she wasn't real, Josh.
Antetokounmpo.
Sounds right to me.
Antetokounmpo. There you go.
Oh my gosh. Amazing.
What about Luka Doncic? You can spell his name?
Luka Doncic. She doesn't know Luka.
Oh, Lukadoncic. Yes, I know.
Of course, I would help that. Yeah.
I want to give you a hug, Martina. Thank you so much.
All right, guys.
We could have done this forever. Please come back and do it another time. Please.
We will. We got to talk more politics next time. See you guys.
Yes. Thank
pleasure.
You.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, bye, Martina.
Bye. All right.
Josh. Oh my gosh, Josh.
Icon. Oh. An icon. I knew she was ahead of her time, but even through speaking with them, like, she was way ahead of her time. She's so brave.
You know what? You and I were both nervous. We talked about it beforehand, and normally we don't get that nervous, you know, basketball guys. And I was a little nervous. The second she came on, I realized I hadn't been nervous enough. Terrified. I was terrified. I would have been throwing up all night if I'd have known that we actually were going to talk to her.
Yeah. I thought you were going to zig and you zagged. Well done. You know, same thing with me. Then I saw her just because she's so, you know, she's down to earth and was doing her thing. So it put me at ease in one way. But then I was just like, what am I going to say? I am afraid.
Well, we said, is there anything you want to talk about or not talk about? She said, I'm sure you guys will come up with something great, not just any of the old, regular old stuff. And I went, oh my God, I think we only have all the old regular old stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Then you were like, scratch the Chris Evans. Yeah. Wimbledon, favorite place.
Everything growing up. Shit, what else is there?
Or grass.
Activism? Can we talk activism?
Huh?
What a fascinating human being. And, you can read about her all you want until you hear her talk about doing the hardest thing, leaving her mom, her dad, her parents, her family, not letting her mom know. It really lets you know how especially tough she is, right?
Yeah, a lot of perspective with her entire life and where we are now and what she went through. And I love what you said. Really difficult things she had to endure, it all came back to, I had already done the hardest thing.
Right.
That was amazing.
Yeah, man, we could have talked to her forever. And she is a basketball fan. That's amazing.
Oh, her left-handed jumper looked good, huh?
Little gooseneck. Mm-hmm. Of course she can. Of course she can. Mm-hmm. I mean, had never picked up a basketball and then start playing one-on-one, two-on-two, and three-on-three. What?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, Josh, that was fun. A lot of fun. Let's come back next week and have another guest. What do you think for episode 20? What will that be? Episode 25, 4. They're all running together. 25. Yes. We're coming up 25. On 25.
Like we said in the intro.
In the intro.
This was 24. That will be 25. Probably didn't remember that.
Yeah, you're right. All right, buddy. Hey, let's do all it right. again. Same time next week on basketballnews.com. Please subscribe, rate, and review.